This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. To be an addict, David Carr writes, is to be something of a cognitive acrobat. You spread versions of yourself around, giving each person the truth he or she needs, you need actually, to keep them at remove. How then to reassemble that montage of deceit into a truthful past? Though Carr is now a successful journalist, he spent years as a crack addict who acted often enough like a thug. When he decided to write his memoir of addiction and recovery, he knew he couldn't trust his own memory to accurately render the story. So he used his reporting skills, conducting 60 interviews and reviewing medical files, legal documents, and journals to reconstruct a version of himself he barely recognized. The result is his new memoir called The Night of the Gun. David Carr has written for The Atlantic Monthly and New York Magazine. He's currently a columnist for The New York Times, focusing on media issues. Well, David Carr, welcome to Fresh Air. I wondered if you'd begin by giving us a taste of your experience by reading this description of addiction from your book on page 91.
This is from chapter 14, Time Heals, Time Forgets. It begins... Mornings for an addict involve waking up in a room where everything implicates him. Even if there is no piss or vomit, oh blessed be the small wonders, there's the tipped over bottle, the smashed phone, the bright midday light coming through the rip in the shade that says another day has started without you. Drunks and addicts tend to build nests out of the detritus of their misbegotten lives. It is that ecosystem, all there for the inventorying within 20 seconds of waking, which tends to make an addiction a serial matter. Apart from the progression of the disease, if you wake up in that kind of hell, you might start looking for something to take the edge off. Nothing like the beer goggles and a nice bracing whiff of something to help you reframe your little disaster area. Just a second here. Little hair of the dog. Now that's better. Everything is new again.
Well, let's talk about your story. You began drinking heavily in college and then traveled around a lot, found your way into journalism in Minneapolis, where much of this story unfolds, and then got into cocaine. Is there a point at which it was clear that this wasn't something recreational, even done occasionally to excess, but something that was really what your life was mostly about?
You know, it's interesting that you say that, Dave, because I don't think that ever occurs to anybody. People bring such monumental denial to the mania of addiction that what is normal keeps changing and morphing until it can accommodate almost anything, which means, yeah, I stayed up till 4 a.m, but boy, I made it to work. Yes, I got to work and I'm reeking of alcohol, but at least I'm here. Yes, I needed a bump at work to get through the day, but at least I stayed put. And somehow the new normal just keeps setting in and setting in and setting in. And so until there was employment or legal or marital intervention, I never really had epiphanies. The police department of Minneapolis tended to do for me what I could not do for myself, which is slow me down, give me some time, sometimes in a holding cell, to think about what I was up to.
How many times were you arrested?
I don't know, a bunch. Probably it's all misdemeanor. I picked up one felony. I was felony charged, but never convicted. I don't know, in Minneapolis and elsewhere, probably 11, 12, 13 times. The cops there got so tired of seeing me that one guy, when I walked in, he looked up and, you know, he saw me and knew I was a frequent flyer and that I had been in there a lot. And he said, well, let me guess, lurking with intent to mope, which is his way of saying, you're just a knock-around guy. You're never going to amount to anything. All you do is float in and out of here. And in the meantime, when I was out at large, I was working fairly industriously as a reporter and trying hard to excel and did, in fact, do well. As a reporter, it's just every once in a while I was upstairs at the police department. Every once in a while I was downstairs where they kept the bad guys.
You know, your addiction went through phases, and it seems that it changed a lot when you went from drinking and snorting powdered cocaine to freebasing and crack. Explain the difference.
You know, I don't even know if how big of an issue crack is these days. I don't know if people are doing it. Back when I was doing it 20 years ago, I think that the issue with crack cocaine and the reason that people end up getting in such profound trouble with it is it provides all of the euphoria and rush of injectable drugs with none of the consequences. There's no needles, there's no blood, there's no nothing. All you do is what you do with a pipe full of tobacco or a pipe full of marijuana. You put a flame to it and it metastasizes into smoke and you take it into your lungs. In the instance of crack cocaine, you have something that's specifically aimed right at your endorphins and sends a ringer right up to the bell almost immediately. And once you experience that, you think, well, I'd like to do that again. The problem is the ringer goes up less and less high each time you do it as your endorphins attenuate. And so that chase sometimes goes on for minutes, days, weeks, and seeking that same result that by now is elusive. You're in an endorphin-depleted state, and the only thing you can do by ingesting smokable cocaine is sort of get back to level, nothing more. I never really knew anybody who did it more than once or twice who didn't end up in a world of hurt because of it. I've never actually met that social crack user.
Well, you know, I found really compelling your description of what crack users are like as distinct from coke users in some way, powdered cocaine users. You said that smoking crack is less of a party and more of a religious ceremony. What's the image there?
If you think of snorting coke, which I know because I live in New York, people still will take a toot here and there. They go into the bathroom and they inhale some coke and then come out and resume drinking and dancing or laughing or whatever they do. That's not the point of the evening. When it comes to crack cocaine, it is the experience. There's only that. It's an indoor activity. It requires equipment. People generally gather in a circle. The pipe is passed from person to person. It's, in sort of practical terms, probably equivalent to some Native American ceremonies for passing the pipe around and sharing some ceremonial time, with the exception that everybody around that pipe is going crazy and losing their mind and just waiting for the next hit. Part of the issue with crack is it goes away very quickly, so it tends to be a very chronic affair. So you do it, and then you do it again, and then you do it again.
And there's not, like, excited conversation? It's not, like, enhancing, you know, the interaction among the people?
People mostly keep an eye on the flame. It seems religious in that way. Just waiting, biding their time, sort of putting their hands on their thighs and waiting. People might make a remark about the size of a particular hit, but it's not like you're going to talk about the Yankees or the Mets or Obama or McCain. It's just not as compelling as your next turn.
Well, David Carr, you were with a number of women in this period of your life. You were apparently a charming guy. Tell us about Anna, the mother of your twins. What kind of person she was?
Anna was a smart, tough cookie from northern Minnesota. Got a lot of bad breaks in terms of her upbringing, and one of the things, her adaptive characteristic was to get involved in selling drugs. She was very good at it. When I met her, she was moving a kilo a month of pressed cocaine, and she had a weakness for losers, and that would have been me, and she tried to enroll me sort of in the business at hand, and we ended up sort of finding each other in weakness. In other words, I lost my job. I was a very successful, award-winning journalist at the time, and she was somebody who was making a lot of money, buying and selling drugs to the elite of the city we lived in Minneapolis, and probably within a year of getting together, we had both lost our respective gigs and were pretty much at bottom. And then I found out that Anna was pregnant. Pretty clear signal from God that it's time to straighten out some lifestyle issues, but that didn't happen. My kids were born 2.5 months premature, and we're in the neonatal intensive care unit at the University of Minnesota for 30 days. And when they came out, I don't think either Anna or I were capable as parents. I mean, they lived with us. We got by after a fashion, but it was clear after a while that the center would not hold.
And when did you know that you had to do something and get yourself into a program?
There was this night when Anna was busy. She was out somewhere, and I was at home, and I was watching the girls, and they were probably, 8 or 9 months, and I was out of drugs, and I was not the kind of person that would leave them home, but I needed to go somewhere. So they came with me, and I left them parked in the car while I went inside for what was supposed to be 5 minutes, and probably turned out to be more like 2 hours. And when I came out, I didn't really know what I would find in that car, you know, two babies alone in a crummy part of the city, cold night, tucked in their snowsuits, and I opened up the door and I could see their breath, and I just, you know, if there's any kind of moment, that was when I just thought, you know, I've been a bad husband. I had been married earlier in life. I never married Anne. I had been a bad sibling. I had been a bad son. I had been a bad employee. There was nothing really in my upbringing that suggested it'd be okay to be a bad father. I was raised well by wonderful parents, and I just got a clear feeling that I was up to something that God would not easily forgive.
So you left the kids with your parents and made your way into rehab, which was a long road. You point out the importance of time and getting out of it. You know, there's a point where you have 12 rules for recovery, not the, you know, the 12 steps that one hears of. But one of them was to go into a rehab place that you never, ever want to go back to. Avoid treatment centers with duck ponds, good food, or a record of admitting Britney Spears. What was your rehab center like?
Eden House, it's still there, 1025 Portland Avenue, low bottom, meaning people probably dually diagnosed with what would be called MICD, where they're mentally incompetent, chemically dependent. Most of the place was criminal justice referrals, so it was people coming out of county jails, state prisons, and some of them were gaming and trying to find a way to shorten their sentence. Some of the people were really actually done, but it was like a house full of 60 knuckleheads. I ended up in charge with the basement, in charge of the kitchen, and there were rats in the basement. Not like abundant, like any sort of old city building, but I have to admit that just absolutely terrified me to go down there in the morning to open up the kitchen. And I, you know, I don't want to pretend like it was Abu Ghraib, but it was a very serious place full of very serious people. And sort of the soft white boy from the suburbs who used to be a journalist, who had self-invented as some kind of half-cocked gangster, I didn't get a lot of play there, I got to say. they were not impressed by me.
You were not the tough guy on the block, huh?
No, I was not. I was an easy mark, but I found real friends in there, friends I have to this day. And it's the kind of place where they have all sorts of goofy slogans like, the answer to life is learning to live. And, you know, when I woke up this morning, I was having a really difficult day today. And there I was saying the goofy slogan from Eden House from Umpty Ump, years ago. The weird thing about all those aphorisms and slogans, millions and millions of people have used them to stay alive. So, you know, I have no, I think you have to be absolutely frantically earnest to find recovery. I went through four treatments sort of motoring along on cynicism and irony. And you know what? Doesn't usually turn out that well.
Right. So you got out and managed to stay clean and take care of these twins and begin your journalistic career, which I want to talk about. How did Anna fare, the mother of the twins?
Anna did okay. She was in short-term hospital treatment, 28 days, came out, was sober for a while. But, you know, I had grown up and I had a craft. I was a journalist and I could find work right away. Her whole history was that she had been involved in the drug lifestyle, and so to make money, she necessarily ended up back with those same folks, and it isn't long before you're going to succumb to the abundant blandishments of that lifestyle. And so I went to pick up the kids one time, and they were wet and tired and hungry, and I took them to 7-Eleven, got them bottles and bananas, and stood in the parking lot and thought, you know what? I'm not going to bring them back.
Tell us about rebuilding your journalistic career. I mean, you had long had a knack for this. You say even when you were using, you went after crooked politicians and stories of trends and social issues in Minneapolis. How long did it take you to get back into being a real successful working journalist?
Well, Dave, you're a journalist, and so you know there is something obsessive and frantic about wanting to know. And so it wasn't like it was a terrible fit to begin with.
Right.
Part of the reason I probably sobered up is I couldn't stand being out of the game. I love writing. I love reporting. And I was in the position of seeing as my whole support system as a single parent of twin baby girls, and I had no idea what I was doing. I was pretty much stuck in Minneapolis, and that meant, well, I was going to work for every single editor that I had kind of screwed over when I was flopping around as an addict. And the trouble with that is, even when you are sincere and you are for real, you're just saying the things that you said the last time around, which is, I'm better, things are going well, I'm going to meetings, everything's great. And then you face plant. And so even though I knew I was back and I knew I was for real, there was no different rhetorical set to really use on people.
But you got a job at a weekly in Minneapolis editing the paper, right? Doing well there. And then ended up in Washington at City Paper, right?
Yep.
Learned to run a staff and help other people do good stories, not just do them yourself. How did you get to the New York Times?
I wonder that sometimes, too, when I walk in there and I wonder if my, like, I'll be traveling on a story and I'll see my luggage bag around and I'll see that tag on my bag and think some horrendous mistake has been made. When I got my job there, my dad said, well, David, you've always wanted to work at the New York Times. And I said, Dad, I've never said that in my life. New York Times is one of humankind's greatest creations. And even though the majesty of it is not always apparent from within, everybody there is trying real hard to make it good. And it's a spectacular work environment in that way. I came to New York, worked for a .com run by Kurt Anderson and Michael Hirschhorn, Deanna Brown, called Inside.com, and went to work at The Atlantic and New York. And I got a call to be a business reporter and cover publishing at the New York Times. And I was skeptical at first, but I had never worked at a daily in my life. I sort of thought a guy should give this a whirl if he's got a shot. I think part of the reason I got hired there is I'd been covering publishing and entertainment on and off for different publications in the city. And even though I sort of fell off a turnip truck and didn't really know anybody and know what I was doing, I fumbled my way to a few decent stories. I'm clearly a productive writer. I'm a person who works a lot, and I'm comfortable in a variety of voices covering a variety of topics. So that makes me a decent tool to have in the belt.
In your book, The Night of the Gun, you use first names for everybody, including in describing your experience at the Times, a reporter named Jason, who ends up getting into trouble for making stuff
up. Jason Blair.
Yeah, we're talking about Jason Blair here, obviously. And he ends up, you end up popping up in his book at a moment when his deceit is all crashing down upon him. Describe that moment, if you would.
Well, I mean, like a lot of people, I really liked Jason. Jason was an extremely charming young man, still is. I don't stay in regular touch with him, but it's so funny, given my background and the amount of sort of pathology I've rubbed up against in my life, that Jason totally got over on me, that I was his last and most stalwart defender, and everyone else had to be crazy, and this, it couldn't have been. I can remember a friend of mine, Eric Wemple at the Washington City Paper, called me and said, now runs it, and says, you know what, these stories are bad. They're bad all the way through, bad to the bone. And I just said, you got it all wrong. And it turned out that Jason had, for reasons I still can't fathom, I don't think he would be able to explain, he more or less wound a rope around his neck and then tied it around our feet, everyone else who was there, and then just like jumped off a cliff. And when it all came crashing down, I felt that Jason, who had a history of drug use, was just going to leave the Times and go west into the projects where he used to cop and probably never come back again. And regardless of what you think of what he did, and I find what he did to be reprehensible and appalling in all regards, because I value so much this thing of ours. But as a human being, and that was the concern of the leadership, Gerald Boyd, now deceased, managers who said, go out and find that kid. Find out what he is doing. And I walked up to him and I gave him a speech, and it was full of all kind of program claptrap and recovery stuff and the things that you say to people when they're in a desperate circumstance. And the weirdest thing was, when his book came out, that whole speech was there, word for word, as I had said it. And I thought to myself, well, if you could do that on the worst day of your life, remember a 200, 300-word speech that a colleague gave you on a street corner, how is it that you couldn't just go and do the news stories? Hmm. What was so hard about that?
You know, I wanted to ask, you know, part of the premise of your book is that a story of addiction and recovery, which, as you said, has been written many times before.
That, and some of it really grand and wonderful, you know. Right. And I tried not to read those books before I got started.
Huh. Why not? You wanted to
just because, you know, you're sort of living the cliche. It's not enough that you spent so much time with your life wrapped around, you know, your lips wrapped around a bottle or a crack pipe or God knows what. It's now that you finally sobered up, why not just shut up about it and get on with it? Why do you have to squeeze something else out of it?
And what's your answer to that?
My answer is that after 14 years sober from very low bottom, I sobered up. I got custody of my twins. I got them off welfare. I got cancer, Hodgkin's lymphoma. As a single parent, survived, prospered, kept my job, ended up running newspapers, met a wonderful woman, married her, had a wonderful kid, and after 14 years of all these promises sort of piling up around me, I decided to pour whiskey on it and give it a try, give being a suburban drunk a try. And it didn't go very well. It lasted about 2.5 years. I got arrested for drunk driving. And about 6 months after it happened, I was due. I really needed to write a book. I had kids going to college. And I thought to myself, you know, for me to do what I did, I've done a lot of forgetting. I don't think if I ever knew who I was, I had forgotten who I was. And worse things could happen for me and for the other people who might read this than for me to really go back and look at what happened. And it's been a nice thing for my health.
You know, I guess one of the things that I wondered was, when one writes a memoir of addiction and recovery solely from their memory, then they're, as you noted, probably getting some very inaccurate stuff, memories, the version that they wanted to hear, and not remembering things that are simply clouded by their substance abuse. When you do it more thoroughly, as you did, and interview people and go through documentary evidence and really try to reconstruct it honestly, do you think the story is fundamentally different? Are there different lessons that you learn from a more...
Wow, what a cool question. I love that. Because the baseline story is the same. You know, I was normal, then I drank or did drugs, then I lost my mind, then I sobered up, now everything is new again. So whether you're sitting in your basement typing about that or going and talking to people, here are some things that I found out. One of the things I found out is it's a tenet of recovery that you must always recover for yourself. Well, I never managed that until I had two sort of defenseless children in my life and they needed parenting. So regardless of what the cliche said, in my own instance, I needed to come to grips with, you know, yes, I'd like to feed the monster, but I'm not willing to destroy children to do it. The other thing is recovery narratives are often writ in personal heroic terms where you, like the story I told standing there with the snowsuits and deciding, well, I'm never going to be this man again. Hey, guess what? My parents were there to take the kids. They put them in temporary foster care with Patrick and Zelda. They looked after them. When I had cancer, my sister came over every single day because I couldn't stand to have anybody else in the house. This whole cliche of the village pulling and lifting the fabric, the fact that we're all in this together, became so manifest in the reporting because when people would talk to me, a lot of times the talk would turn away from me and turn to the people around me, the people who lifted me and pulled me at every single turn. And I think you forget that. I think people who make it to the other side seem to think that they had a moment of clarity and then everything was made new again. Didn't happen that way.
Well, David Carr, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It was an absolute pleasure.
New York Times columnist David Carr. His memoir of addiction and recovery is called The Night of the Gun. A reporter investigates the darkest story of his life, his own.